The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and South Jersey. Welcome to Inside Medicine. I have lined up an excellent program today. We have Professor Jasjit Sadev. He is a pain specialist, and he's going to educate us on pain, which nobody wants to talk about, but there's many, many different pain syndromes, such as post-mastectomy pain, phantom limb pain, trigeminal neuralgia, medical marijuana issues, non-opiate analgesic issues, and we are going to have an expert help us out. And I just want to open up that Bill Walton passed away this year, a fantastic basketball player, actually recently, and he was quoted in Investor's Business Daily. Life is easy when you're hot, but what happens when the ball bounces the other way? You just keep getting back up and climbing up. That's the way you approach pain. So when it comes to conflict, we are often our own worst enemies. Quote, it is not the difficult person on the other side of the table. It's the person on the side of the table. It is us. It is our natural, very human, very understandable tendency to react out of fear and anger. That kind of applies to pain to me, and I'm so happy that we have Dr. Jasjit today on for us. And I want to welcome you. He's a professor at Cooper University. Welcome to Inside Medicine.
Hi, Dr. Joe Fallon. Thank you so much for having me on today. So I want to say hi to all of the listeners that tuned in today. My name is Dr. Jasjit Sadev, but, you know, my friends, and as we can do on this podcast today, on this radio show today, you can call me Jazz. It just makes it easier. That's what my friends and family call me. So I'm very passionate about, you know, treating pain and pain management in general. And the theme of today and the theme of the podcast and the radio show today and what I want to get across is that I want patients to know that, you know, we want to treat your pain and treat your pain in a way that's tailored to you, because you're not just a syndrome, you're not just your symptoms, you're not just a category or a number on a sheet of paper, you're a person with feelings and experiences. And we as humans have to realize that everybody experiences pain on a different level, and everybody has different reactions to pain. And as you quoted Bill Walton earlier, it's important to remember that it's not the, you know, a lot of people bring up how, you know, they go through issues and problems and we have trials and tribulations, but it's not the problems that we face, but how we react to them. And that's kind of the theme of pain as well. When we're dealing with pain, we have to realize that there's a emotional, psychological, mental aspect to pain, not just the biology aspect of pain. There's multiple components to the human experience that can impact how patients, you know, experience pain. And as an endocrinologist, Joe, I'm sure you know how patients react when, you know, they have diabetes and they have peripheral neuropathy. I'm sure you can kind of chime in on that too, that patients have extreme pain and it can be difficult to treat and complex. And so we have to tailor the treatment to the patient. So I want the listeners to know that that's what we aim to do. And that's what I aim to do. As a member of the Cooper Pain Management Team, we all try to do our best to treat you as an individual for your pain and your individual needs.
So, Jasjit, can you focus on post-mastectomy pain? That's going to interest, I guess, 50% of our audience today. I'm glad you're doing it, not me.
Well, Joe, you know, I got to say, first of all, that intro music, that you're a superhero, and I'm just, you know, as my mentor, I want to try to follow in your footsteps in the way that you've really paved the way for young physicians like me, trying to, you know, make an impact on the community and our patient population. So, post-mastectomy pain syndrome is very complex. Patients with cancer patients with a benign tumor, if they get a lumpectomy, if you get a mastectomy, if they have lymph node dissections, all of this stuff sounds very familiar. And then the process of having cancer with a possible chemotherapy and radiation therapy, both separate treatments to treat for cancer, can leave patients with neuralgias in, you know, scar tissue, and those can, you know, cause inflammation and chronic pain. And so I work very closely with some of the MD Anderson cancer doctors. We have phenomenal breast surgeons, and they, as much as, you know, they can do to take away the cancer and remove it and work their magic and use their skill sets, sometimes the patients get chronic pain in their chest, in their axilla, in their armpit, sometimes in the base of their arm, and that can be debilitating and very painful. And so it can impact their day-to-day lives, and we try to do what we can to treat it. Initially, patients will, you know, probably get some imaging done. They can go to physical therapy. They can try different medications. And with a relationship that I've built with some of the MD Anderson cancer doctors, they came to me and said, hey, can you do anything for this? And I said, sure, let's try to look at it. And for me, the way my mind works, I try to find, you know, solutions to problems and fix things. And, you know, one of the things I, you know, find is that sometimes we can't go by the textbooks on these things, and we have to try new things and new therapies. So I've worked with them, and we've done a few different types of blocks that have helped, and a few different interventions that have helped. So for patients with that cancer pain in the intercostal, the chest region with the nerves there, intercostal brachial nerves, the serratus nerves, we can do certain nerve blocks that really have made a major impact, to the point where we're now going to potentially look at how this affects patients on a percentage scale, on a mass scale, and see if there's validity to some of the data behind this, that where can we really make a big impact on this cancer population and treat them. So post-mastectomy pain syndrome can be very debilitating. We can try medications, but when we haven't been able to come to a good treatment plan or a good, rather, pain tolerance level for the patient and comfort level for the patient, we've done serratus anterior nerve blocks, intercostal nerve blocks, and they've really made a major impact. And they have going back, they get their life back. They're able to move their arm and lift their arm above their head and reach up and do some of those things that post-mastectomy pain can limit their function.
Judge, what exactly is a nerve block? Can you help out the audience here?
Sure. So a nerve block is essentially where we use image guidance with fluoroscopy or ultrasound to place a needle close to the area and sometimes in the area where the pain is coming from and originating. We can do a nerve block at the area and proximal or, you know, at the beginning of the nerve, and use a combination of steroid, which is dexamethasone or Kenalog or triamcinolone, and then mix some local anesthetic in there to help with the pain and inflammation. The local anesthetic helps to help with the immediate inflammation and pain from the procedure, and the steroid helps to limit the and calm down the inflammation of the scar tissue, surrounding connective tissue, and the nerve.
So my impression is it's quite successful. Can you give us some feedback on that?
Yes. So with serratus anterior blocks, intercostal nerve blocks, we've had very good success where patients have had at least 50% pain relief, which is the measure and standard for how we try to look at success with therapies, and also range of motion, function, and reduction in their medication use for pain medicine. So we've seen that on case-by-case basis for these blocks that I've been doing for the past 5 years now with collaboration with the breast and cancer doctors.
So really what you're saying is that those nerves, when they get knocked out, the patient gets relief, and additionally that allows them more mobility so that they're, quote, back to a more natural state. Is that correct?
Correct. And when we bring this up, I kind of want to highlight how patients can have this pain that leads them to feel scared and maybe feel anxious. We have a term called kinesiophobia, and it's a large term that basically means they're scared to move. And so when you have pain in that area, you don't want to cause that pain again. So it's a combination of the pain, limitation in function over time, and then sometimes stiffness that leads to this long-term chronic pain. And so doing a nerve block is one component to it, doing physical therapy, trying some medications, and overall looking at the bigger picture of how we can treat pain on many different levels helps the patient regain function and reduce their medication use and improves their overall quality of life.
So if somebody gets a nerve block and it's successful, do they ever need any other medication and backup to make sure that they get that relief, preferably 99% of the time, which probably is a very high goal to reach?
Yeah, the goal is really to honestly help patients get 100% relief. But if we have to live in the real world and the human experience, and we can't always guarantee 100%. That's why we shoot for 50%. And if, you know, we get that relief and the patients are able to regain function, that's considered a win. In most scenarios, you're going to have pain that sometimes comes back. And if it does, it's good to know that there's treatment options that are more, you know, advanced. And some of these nerve blocks can be very advanced and specific to the area. Now, if a nerve block helps, but the pain comes back, we can repeat the shots and it's safe. It doesn't cause any long-term harm to the patient, to the to their body, and to the nerve. And so overall, these patients can have repeat injections as long as they're helping. And if they're not helping, or for example, if it helps and the pain comes back too quickly, we have other advanced options like radio frequency ablation, which is heat therapy. We have cooled or cryotherapy, which is cooled ablation. We have also nerve stimulation that we can do as well. And we can go into more detail about that later on the show, but I don't want to focus on post-mastectomy pain. We have options beyond just the nerve block, too, that are more advanced.
Fantastic. So let's just, because we've got a few pain issues to deal with here today. So what is phantom limb pain?
So phantom limb pain is very interesting because one thing about pain in that we in our view and our perspective on pain is that the common person, I mean, most people will think that if someone has pain, it's a biological process. There's something pathologically wrong. And therefore, if we remove the wrong, we won't have pain anymore. Phantom limb pain is very interesting because if a patient has pain in their foot, and I'm sure, Joe, you've seen this too, that if a patient has diabetic painful ulcers or painful neuropathy and then have to get an amputation, they get that body part removed. And that hopefully and theoretically we would think that, okay, I removed the bad part of the body and therefore it's no longer going to hurt. Well, phantom limb pain is a sensation and a painful sensation that your brain still thinks that that body part is still there. And unfortunately, it's such a discomforting experience, that patients experience this pain that my foot's still there. It feels sleepy. It feels like it's asleep. It feels like it's burning, throbbing. No matter what the experience is, if it's discomforting, it can impact that person's life, despite them losing that body part that was causing them pain.
Well, that sounds very challenging to me, because if you ain't got it and it's causing pain, that's just very confusing to at least my brain. So how do you deal with phantom limb pain?
It's very complex. It's not an easy answer. And the best thing that we can do is use all the tools that we have with technology, with the medicine that we know to help with patients' experience and with their pain. So with phantom limb pain, initially patients will go through physical therapy. We can try some medications. We can use all the different pharmaceuticals that we have and use biofeedback and cognitive behavioral therapy as well, which are other forms of treatment that we have at Cooper as well. We use these different things to see if that controls their pain. Now, if it doesn't, we have other types of interventions that we can do to help. One is a sympathetic nerve block, where we do an injection at the sympathetic nerves. That's the chain of nerves at the front of the vertebral body, where we perceive these pain sensations along the sympathetic nerve pathway, and we can do those nerve blocks there. If we don't get relief with that sympathetic nerve block, then we can move to more advanced types of therapy, and this involves neurostimulation, and we can do nerve stimulation to see if that can help as well.
So what exactly is nerve stimulation? Because those nerves are already dysfunctional. and what does nerve stimulation mean? And if there was an anterior sympathetic, is there a posterior cholinergic? How does that all work out?
No, the sympathetic nerves pretty much relay the pain in with relation to phantom limb pain to the spinal cord and then to our brain. So the main thing that we want to take away from this is that there are many pathways where nerves, where pain rather can be felt. We can have nerve pain felt in the initial area of the nerve endings when tissue damage happens. Then along the nerve pathway, and if the nerve is compressed in any way, the nerve damage can happen there, or the pain source can happen there. And we have to keep that in mind, that there's different, you know, areas where there can be the source of the pain. And then the nerve then travels into the spinal cord that then eventually gets collaborated into this area called the dorsal column where the spinal thalamic nerves are, and those nerves then go to the brain, and then the brain can then perceive pain. So at any point, if you are able to, you know, limit the inflammation or limit the sensation of pain and the inflammation with the pain, then you can cut down the patient's feeling or discomfort and their experience of the pain. So dorsal column stimulation is one of the nerve stimulation sites along the spinal cord that you can block the pain signals and kind of scramble the pain signals from going to the brain. There's also dorsal root ganglion stimulation, where dorsal root ganglion stimulation is where we specifically put it along specific nerves that are more focused on a specific dermatome. And a dermatome is basically where nerves are, or your body, you feel certain sensations in specific areas that then go into the vertebral body and the spinal cord and then to the brain. And then we can do peripheral nerve stimulation as well, where you can go be like more distal and on the endings of the nerves closer to where the pain source could be. So we have to keep in mind, where is the pain source coming from, and where and how can we block that pain signal before it goes to the brain?
Okay, well, Jasjit, all I can say, it sounds like a New York City traffic mix-up to me, so I'm glad you're there. So the question is that phantom limb pain has many different sites that you have to assess and then try and take out that issue. So if phantom limb pain comes, how often do people get better with your guidance?
So majority of the time, we are able to come to a solution and a treatment plan that's tailored to the specific patient and where their nerve is coming from. So firstly, we work with the surgeons and we ask them and talk to them and say, hey, did everything go okay with the surgery? And do you think that there's any nerve compression at the sites where you did the surgery? And they'll let us know what they feel. And if a patient has a specific focal point on their, you know, where they had the amputation and the stump, that could be one of the sources of where the pain is. And then when we try physical therapy, which generally helps most patients, we don't have to intervene with pharmaceuticals. Then the next step will be try pharmaceuticals. And then if the pharmaceuticals don't work, we can do nerve blocks. If nerve blocks don't work, we can then advance to do nerve stimulation and more advanced treatments. So there, rest assured that most patients will come away with a treatment plan that they have good relief, where they're able to regain their function, where they're able to get their quality of life back. We just have to figure out where the patient, you know, is on the, in terms of their pain, and what can we do to treat it. And with a consultation and with your pain, with the pain specialist, you can certainly come up with the plan that's best for you.
Well, I am glad we have three specialists in that area, Cooper, that can help the patients out, because it's just like I say, it's a traffic deal, and you guys know how to figure it out, and you've got the advanced way of doing business. So, good. Let me just move on a second. My area, diabetic painful neuropathy. I mean, it's incredible how often people want to go towards a narcotic when they get pain. So how do you guys handle diabetic painful neuropathy?
It's something that I could even ask you too, Jill. How do you handle patients with painful neuropathy? Well, you know, it's very complex, and you know that it's very complex, because diabetes is a silent killer. It's something that we see a lot in our patient populations. You know, first and foremost, when you see a patient, I know you do your best to make sure you educate the patient on lifestyle changes. So that's the first step you can do, is control your blood sugar by modifying your lifestyle. whether it's diet, exercise, and you know, so on and so forth, you can certainly get to a non-pharmaceutical, non-interventional, non-injection-based way of helping with diabetic painful neuropathy. But when those things don't work, when those modifications and changes and don't work, then we have to consider other treatment options. And the World Health Organization has a very good resource for the WHO pain ladder, and we follow that model because it's very good. It's been proven and tried and tested. So we try first to, you know, with the medications, they can be non-opiate or non-narcotic pain medicines. So Tylenol, our regular Tylenol over the counter, Motrin, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And then if we need to use more prescription or stronger drugs, we can use those that are non-narcotic based. And those can be things like gabapentin, the other name is Neurontin, pregabalin or Lyrica. And then we may be able to use some other newer drugs that are out there, like tapentadol. And then if we need to consider using narcotics, we can go to narcotics as well. But we want to first focus on the patient and say, is this the best medication for them? And is this something that's going to help them? And if it doesn't, then it shouldn't be used. And then if we're not able to come to a pharmaceutical conclusion or, you know, medical conclusion with helping with the pain through those avenues, then we can consider some of the similar blocks that I mentioned with phantom limb pain, such as sympathetic nerve blocks, sometimes epidural steroid injections, and then we can even consider spinal cord stimulation, which is a newer FDA-approved therapy for diabetic painful neuropathy.
So can you describe what that is? The newer approved how to deal with painful diabetic neuropathy.
Oh, okay, yes. So neural stimulation, it's been around for about 2 to 3 decades, and we've been using this therapy, and it's been advancing, and it's been getting better and better. I have patients that have said, oh, I've tried neural stimulation, didn't work for me, but there's newer, you know, more advanced techniques now with spinal cord stimulation and dorsal root ganglion stimulation that can now tailor therapy to specific patients and their specific needs. So let's say a patient just has foot pain, and we, you know, the traditional nerve stimulation people remember that spinal cord stimulation can stimulate the back and the legs. So sometimes they can feel a tapping or a buzzing sensation in their back called a paresthesia, and they will feel that sensation in their back and their leg. And sometimes they don't like that sensation because they don't have back pain and they just want to stimulate maybe just the top of their foot where they're having pain. So we can use dorsal root ganglion stimulation or peripheral nerve stimulation to specifically stimulate that nerve to block the pain signals and have those signals scrambled so they don't go to the brain, and then that's where you feel the sensation.
So basically your job is to make sure that pain signals don't get to the brain. Would that be your job?
Yeah, we're kind of working with the electrical components of the body to basically find the problem and reset it, essentially. So we don't want those pain signals going. And just like a computer can sometimes, you know, malfunction, and sometimes you have to turn it off and turn it on. Sometimes that's what we have to do with our nerves. We have to turn it off and turn it back on again, and sometimes that's how we reset themselves. So a nerve block can function in that way to reset it. It can also function to reduce inflammation with using steroids. So we have the same modality with different mechanisms of action to help with pain.
So it's getting a little bit on the complex side, but how many freaking nerves are there in the body? I guess you're the best person to ask that, but I wonder if you can count that high.
I don't know if I can count that high. There's plenty of nerves that we have in our body, and they're distributed all over. And unfortunately, with diabetes and painful neuropathy, they affect the small fiber nerves in our feet and our hands. And so we get that glove and stocking sensation where that hurts in the distal portion of our nerves. And so those nerves, there's millions of them. And unfortunately, you have to try different modalities to help it, but it's very difficult to treat. There are other modalities too that I didn't mention too, but those involve sometimes creams like Qtenza and some of the capsaicin creams, lidocaine, diclofenac. Those are other options too. But again, you know, we have to look at every single component and every single thing that we can use to our advantage to help with pain in such a complex scenario, you know.
So you mentioned diclofenac. I mean, that's one of the drugs. I think that was Mickey Mantle's drug, and It's been very successful for musculoskeletal issues for when patients come in that they were weekend warriors or something. So for diabetic neuropathy, I mean, the goal is, nobody gets this, but, you know, when you get a narcotic from a physician, people walk in and say, Dr. Fallon, can you give me a narcotic? They don't understand that when I write a narcotic, it's going to go out to the state of Delaware, the state of Pennsylvania, the state of New York, and the state of New Jersey when I write it. And there's very tight control on, you know, narcotic type medications, and the patients just don't get it. But, you know, you'll get a call from the higher ups, you know, how much narcotic are you giving out, Fallon, for this patient? So just give me a little insight from your side of the fence, because you're taking care of patients who really have pain. And how does narcotics go in your practice? Because it's hard, no one gets it, but it's hard to give those things out.
Yeah, and this is where I can speak about our group a little bit and then go into detail about how we handle patients with narcotics and use narcotics to our advantage. So firstly, there's a quote I like to say, because basically, you know, we want to have everything in moderation, including moderation. And that's how we have to approach it. With medications that we use, we have to be very careful about how we selectively use them. So in our group, it's Dr. Michael Sabia, Dr. Kingshuk Ganguly, and then we have four nurse practitioners that we use to help us out to get patients in, treat them, and effectively take care of their pain. At the same time, though, we are only seven of us. And for us to handle the thousands of patients in South Jersey that we have to work with our primary care specialists, our endocrinologists, our physicians to basically help with patients with pain. In some cases, they may have to prescribe medications for their primary care population. Now, with narcotic use, you have to be very selective and very careful about when we decide to use this medication, because at the end of the day, narcotics are very dangerous. They are the leading cause of pharmaceutical death in the U.S. because they can cause respiratory depression, and they can cause people to overdose and lose consciousness. So we want to be very careful about how we prescribe these medicines. And if a patient is a good candidate to try the medication, it's okay to prescribe the medication and try the medication on a short-term and maybe long-term basis, but we want to keep in mind, what's the end goal, right? And if the end goal is to reduce the pain, narcotics are not a great option long-term, because they're great for the short-term. They're great, like you said, in wartime. If, you know, patients have a major tissue injury, patients are going for surgery, they're used very well. They're used very well in anesthesia as well. But then when we use them from converting them from acute to chronic, we have to make sure that if we're using them for chronic pain management, that the patients are really getting the therapy that they need. So are the patients getting better, moving better? Are they walking better? Are they able to function better? Is their day-to-day life, quality of life improving? Are they able to go back to work? And then are they experiencing any side effects from the medications too? Because these medications, despite, you know, being able to have tolerance, there's certain things that the side effects that you don't get tolerance to, and that includes constipation. And there's something called opioid-induced hyperalgesia. And that's very complex too, because after a while, if a patient's been on narcotics for years, they can actually get worse. And so it's a double-edged sword. And we have to be careful about how we use narcotics. And in select patients, it's great. And in other patients, it's not so great.
Got it. So how about just jumping a second to non-opioid analgesics? Because a lot of the docs will try and use those because it doesn't have the stigma of the being on a narcotic. But if you need a narcotic, you should get a narcotic. But how do you guys handle other options for the patient that maybe they're afraid of getting, quote, addicted? What are the other non-opioid analgesics that your group would use?
Sure. So there's the traditional over-the-counter medications that we're all familiar with, Tylenol, Aleve, ibuprofen, Motrin. And then you can use things like, you know, lidocaine, which comes in a cream, it comes in a gel, and it comes in a patch form. Now, there are other medications I mentioned earlier, like gabapentin and pregabalin. So they both work on the calcium channels on the nerve, and they function to basically calm down the pain signals. Now, when I talk about this medication, people say, well, gabapentin, isn't that an anti-epileptic or anti-seizure medicine? I say, yeah, it is, actually. But the medication is not very effective for seizures, as you know. And so it's been repurposed and reused that we realized that this medication is actually pretty good for pain. Patients may even remember and may recall that some of their pets, when they go to the veterinarian, the vets do prescribe gabapentin for your cats, dogs, pets, and for their pain syndromes too, but at a much lower milligram dosage. And so gabapentin and pregabalin are very good medications, and they can be used for diabetic painful neuropathy too. And we are able to use those to our advantage to help patients with pain because although being a controlled substance, they do carry their risks as well. And the good thing is that they're not addictive and they're not narcotics. So you won't have some of those other side effects. But as with any pain medicine or any medication in general, you're going to run the risk of other side effects. And those can include things like nausea, vomiting, you know, upset stomach, feeling a little disoriented or not yourself, sedation, drowsiness. So we have to keep that in mind, too, that when we try these different medicines, is it causing any of these side effects and is it getting the goal that we want? Because that's the end. That's the purpose, is the goal. The goal is to regain your function and regain your life.
That is well stated. Let me just ask you, what about lidocaine? Because lidocaine, you know, people ask for the patches. They just don't know that they're pretty darn expensive overall. Do you find that lidocaine works for peripheral neuropathy? Just looking for your insight into lidocaine because it is an expensive RX.
Yeah, so the lidocaine comes in 4% and 5% patches, and then it also comes in the cream form, which can vary in percentage as well. And the lidocaine patch or cream can be, or gel, can be placed over top of the area where you have your pain, and that's how it's most effective. If you place it above the area where you have your pain, I haven't seen patients do extremely well with that. So usually it's over the area where they have their pain. And lidocaine is a numbing agent. So it works on the sodium channels on your nerve to, again, block the pain signals. And that's kind of the theme that we were discussing earlier.
Okay. And then just moving on to one of the newer ones, and that's capsaicin. I think there's ways of, you know, you coat someone's skin if they have, you know, pain from their foot down up to their knee or something. Can you give us a little scoop on capsaicin, which seems to be gaining some ground? I think Hopkins kind of pushed this capsaicin RX forward.
Yeah, and we can, you know, kind of also tie that into other herbals too. So capsaicin is an extract from the chili pepper capsicum, and it has analgesic properties, which are interesting because initially we know capsaicin, like when you're chopping peppers and whatnot and you're, you know, putting them on your fingers, initially there's a little bit of a burn and that can feel very discomforting. And then there's a little bit of a numbing after that too. And so that's kind of a patient's experience. The capsaicin can be placed over top of the area where you have your pain, and that can help. It's initially a little bit of a burn, which is, some patients can't tolerate that, so it's not a good treatment for them. But some patients, they feel great after it, and it does help them. So it comes in a cream form. It comes in a patch form that can be placed over top of the area. And if it's something where it does effectively help with their pain, they can use it on an as-needed basis. Other herbals and things like that can be used, like turmeric, we can use that as well, ginger, and some of the other things that we have that are in our household can also be used to help with inflammation too. So we have to keep in mind that when we bring up capsaicin, I'm also going to tie it into herbals because these are naturally, you know, things that exist, chemicals that exist that we can use to help our pain and inflammation.
So just to, I appreciate that. Just to move forward a little bit, one of the severest pains apparently by history is trigeminal neuralgia. So I would assume those patients can have severe pain and sometimes get surgical interventions. And I'm not really that comfortable. I don't get that often. But can you help us out what trigeminal neuralgia is, and do you guys deal with that?
Yes, so we do treat that as well. Now, trigeminal neuralgia is a syndrome where patients can have pain in the trigeminal nerve in their face. So common things that can happen is sometimes it could be an enlarged blood vessel, it could be a tumor that's pushing on the nerve, it could be something with soft tissue in the area that could be compressing the nerve. Sometimes it can be related to a dental procedure, so if they had a root canal or they had a dental nerve block in that area where they block the nerve. Sometimes that can cause inflammation. And initially, you know, we would treat that relatively conservatively, and we try different medications to see if that helps. But if the conservative treatment doesn't work, then we can try a trigeminal nerve block. And sometimes if we need to go as far as a trigeminal nerve ablation, we do pulsed ablations, we do cooled ablations, and we can also do radio frequency ablations. So they all are helpful to use all of those different modalities and therapies that we have to help with the pain. Now, when I do a trigeminal nerve block for a patient, just like with most of my nerve blocks that I do, I can, you know, sit the patient down with their face down, and I can use x-ray guidance to put the needle close to the trigeminal nerve. And then I can inject numbing medicine with a little bit of steroid called dexamethasone to help with the inflammation, and patients generally have pretty good relief. I have patients who are on, you know, who've had cancer, B-cell lymphoma infecting in that area, affecting that area rather. And they have pain even despite being treated for their, you know, B-cell lymphoma, and they're doing better now. And unfortunately, you know, they have this nerve pain where I have to treat them. And when I have a few patients in particular, I have to give them narcotics when they have their flare. And then if they have their flare, they know they want to call me and come in, and I do the injection. And then they reduce the amount of pain medication they use, and they go on their life and they enjoy. So trigeminal neuralgia can be very painful, especially with just day-to-day eating. You know, opening, closing your mouth and talking. So it's something that it can be extremely painful, and we have to use our different tool sets as physicians to treat the pain specifically tailored to each person.
So this may be a dumb question, but how dangerous is it to go after that trigeminal nerve? Is there anything that's associated with the area that you have to go to infect that?
And this is where it's extremely important to, you know, be with a pain specialist, a board certified pain specialist. So our three pain doctors at Cooper Pain Management are double board certified in both anesthesiology and pain medicine, interventional pain management specifically. And so you want to be with a pain specialist who knows and has experience with doing this, because there are very delicate structures in the area that you do not want to touch and you do not want to affect. So with in the hands of a specialist, a trained specialist with experience, it is very safe to do it, because we use x-ray guidance, we put the needle close to the area, we watch the medicine go in using contrast, and then we can then make the assessment if it's safe to inject, and then we inject the medication. So under a trained a professional, it is very safe to do, and I have had very good outcomes with trigeminal nerve blocks and ablations.
Okay, fantastic. So let me just move on a second. There's something that I'm not really that familiar with. Vertebrogenic pain, can you help define what that is? Because I wasn't aware of it.
Sure. So the pain that comes from the back and spine is also very complex too, and as with the human body and the human experience with perceiving pain. So within the spinal canal, obviously there's all of our nerves start from there, right? We have our nerves come from our brain, go down to the spinal cord, and then out from the spinal cord, and then, you know, going off from there. So in the spine itself, there is a nerve called the basal vertebral nerve, which is primarily where you sense the pain coming from the vertebral body. And so vertebrogenic pain has to do it specifically with the spine itself having pain. We can call that axial nerve pain, vertebrogenic pain. It's very similar, but we have to, you know, tease out exactly where the pain is coming from. So if the pain is coming from a disc herniation and inflammation in the disc that's affecting the end plates of the vertebral body, that can affect the patient, and they can feel pain when moving, bending forward, twisting, laying down sometimes as well. So we have to tailor the treatment to them. And vertebrogenic pain specifically is about the vertebral body and the end plates of the disc being inflamed, and that causes the pain and the sensation that patients feel in their back.
So are you saying what happens is the spine gets a crunch and it puts pressure, the bone goes to bone, one disc on top of the other goes and then squeezes the nerve, and the nerve yells out?
It sometimes isn't even that. So what you're describing is a disc herniation where the disc gets crunched, and then you can think of the disc as like a jelly donut, and it has gel on the inside and it's a hard exterior. So that hard exterior can push out into the spinal canal and compress the nerve, which can feel like pain in their back shooting to the leg. So we call that sciatica or radiculitis. And so that nerve pain, that's from the disc pinching out into the spinal canal. Now that level of inflammation can also cause that vertebrogenic pain with the end plates in the vertebral body on the bones getting inflamed. But you can also have inflammation without having a disc herniation or that crunch. And so that's what makes it challenging to treat, because vertebrogenic pain specifically and only refers to the vertebral body and the end plates being inflamed and having pain. So that can happen from even sometimes patients can have a Schmorl's node, which is basically a benign finding. It's a benign issue. It's not cancer related, but it's there in the spine. And that can cause inflammation in the vertebral body without having any crunching on the disc. So it's important that if the patient has pain to get the proper imaging, specifically a CT scan or an MRI, and MRIs are very good at looking at the details within the spine, and you can see if there is a crunch on the disc or a herniation on the disc, or is it something more benign that's just a Schmorl's node or one of these benign findings that can cause the inflammation.
So what happens, do you ever get, I don't think this happens to you, but do you guys ever get called into labor and delivery when somebody is in incredible pain, do you have to hit a certain area when it's someone delivering a baby? Or maybe you don't get involved in that.
So I have been trained and I have practiced as an anesthesiologist with pregnant patients and giving them labor epidurals. So I spent the first 6 years of my career doing that and very comfortable with doing that as well. So when a patient goes into labor and gets an epidural, they get a catheter placed within the spinal canal that can then supply numbing medicine and a little bit of pain medicine to help with the labor pain. And that's through an epidural catheter. So that's placed in through the skin into the epidural space and then can supply medication to the pregnant patient so that they don't feel as much pain as they're going through labor. So I have done that and I don't do that currently. I focus on chronic pain right now. And yes, that is something that I have a lot of experience in.
So let me ask you this: when someone gets to that during labor, where exactly are you trying to hit? In other words, where is the nerve that you want to numb out? Or is that a dumb question?
No, it's not. Not at all. So when a patient is having labor pain, they can feel pain from the area of the belly from T10. So we have vertebral bodies named for each level. From T10, which is around the area of the belly button down. So from that area, we want to try to get the needle to be placed around the L3, L4, or L5 region. And we put the needle into the epidural space using an epidural needle and then place the catheter through the needle into the epidural space. And we want to get it about 5 to 7 centimeters into the space, and then generally, we put enough medication where if we need to, we can get enough numbing and analgesic relief from the belly button down if needed. But most patients only need it from about L2, L3 down for labor. And the reason why I bring up T10 is because then, say, for example, the patients have to go into a C-section, the epidural can be used not only just for labor pain, but also for the C-section as well.
Got a two-for-one-er, huh? Just to make sure we're covered. One last thing about that. So my wife, she had an epidural, and it was interesting that it relieved the pain everywhere, but in like one area above her knee, or it was above her knee or below her knee, I can't remember, but she said that everything worked great except one little area. What do you think was the issue for that? I mean, you know, one little area doesn't get the relief.
Yeah, and that's interesting because that's where we have to tailor everybody's needs to them to their pain. And so within the epidural space, we have different structures that are there. You can have connective tissue, you have adipose tissue, which is fat cells, you have your nerves, you have your blood vessels like arteries and veins that are in there. And so sometimes you can have connective tissue that kind of blocks the communication in the epidural space. So the epidural space is the space around the spinal cord and spinal cord itself, and between that and the bones of the vertebral body and your spine. So that is an area where we inject medicine to help numb the area. And for pain purposes, we use that to inject steroid to help reduce inflammation. So if there is a connective tissue or scar tissue that's there that blocks the medicine from going into the different areas, so an epidural catheter may not supply the medication to a specific area because of the placement of the catheter itself. So it may need to be adjusted, or maybe more medication needs to be put in to get that relief. So it could have been that just that she was getting enough medication, but not enough to the point where it got to that specific spot where the nerve is for the knee around L4. Maybe she just didn't get enough of that, or there was a connective tissue, you know, scar tissue blocking the medication pathway.
All right. So I'm going to tell her today that I got an answer for her that was, 30 years ago. So let me just move on to a hot item. Medical marijuana. So what's your take on medical marijuana? Because a lot of action on that, you know, when does someone's brain fully develop so it wouldn't have a negative, you know, effect? How do you guys handle medical marijuana consults for pain?
Sure. So medical marijuana is now a more up and coming and more common, I wouldn't say common, but it's becoming more readily used. Patients are going to medical marijuana for pain treatment, and that's okay. There are different components within the drug itself, marijuana, that can affect the body and the brain. So THC is one of the components, and don't ask me to pronounce it properly, but THC is one of the components. CBD is another component, and THC essentially it creates that euphoria or high sensation people feel. And that, unfortunately, while helping and may be perceived as helped for the patient, it's not necessarily the true mechanism for pain relief, because it really just creates a high, a euphoric sensation. And that's something that patients can build tolerance to, and so something that may not be effective. So THC is not something that the pain community generally pushes or is a proponent of for pain relief. It may help with anxiety. It may help with other areas of pathologies for the patient, but it doesn't help as much for pain. CBD, however, cannabinoid, does help with pain and has been used in the form of creams, oils, ingestibles. Sometimes you can use it as gummies, as they have at the medical marijuana dispensaries, and that does help with pain perception. So we have a few receptors in our spine, in our brain, CB1 and CB2, which allow the body to feel less pain sensation when you use CBD, which is the component of marijuana that gives pain relief.
So when people go to one of these marijuana centers, which agent do they give? Or is that not in your area?
Yeah, we see, as a pain specialist, I have to be familiar, and we're educated to be familiar with the different modalities of pain, and we have to keep up with the times and the new therapies and treatments. So as a pain physician, I try to be open-minded for all of the different things that can help, whether it be herbals, whether it be marijuana, whether it be injections, whether it's new technology and new procedures that can be helpful. And I'll go back to the vertebrogenic pain to bring up new procedures, but we use everything in our tool set to help for each patient. And so when a patient goes to a marijuana dispensary, they, you know, want to ask for a higher percentage of CBD.
Okay. So have you seen any, trying to look for the negatives, have you seen any negatives with the use of marijuana or CBD for pain?
There are negatives, and there aren't necessarily going to be one thing that fixes everything. And with everything in moderation, including moderation. So when we're looking at marijuana, you know, as with any drug, you can get addicted to it. The THC component, unfortunately, does have a component that does interact with use of narcotics. And so it's the pain specialties and pain societies have warned the use of marijuana with the use of opiates, because it does have an increased risk of causing opiate overdose and death. if patients were to combine both. Just like if you were to combine alcohol or a benzodiazepine with a narcotic, you have to be careful with using those things. So, and obviously, long-term studies and things, there are different studies that show different things, but they're starting to tie it with Alzheimer's and amnesia and cognition, things like that, which can also be not, if it does cause long-term problems, it's not something that you would want to use then.
So can I ask you just maybe to describe your two associates, because there's three of you guys doing a great job over at Cooper. Can you maybe just give us a little update on your two partners?
Yes. So Dr. Michael Sabia and Dr. Kingshuk Ganguly are my colleagues that I work with, and I have a set of four nurse practitioners that we work with as well. We have three different sites that we work out of. We work out of Camden, New Jersey, from the main hospital at 3 Cooper Plaza. We also work out of Voorhees, New Jersey at 900 Centennial Boulevard. And I'm happy to announce that we have a new area where we opened at Morristown near the mall where the old Sears used to be. And we have a clinic ambulatory site as well as a surgery center that we just started doing procedures out there. And so we're out there as well. So I'm happy to announce that we're expanding and we're having new sites where we're accepting new patients and using our skill sets to help our patients and tailor their pain to them.
Well, you guys definitely have good skill sets. I got to say that because the patients like your work. I have one other question here. Capsaicin, there's this new thing that people will go into the doctor's office. I think Hopkins did this. And they apply capsaicin up to your knee for pain relief with diabetic neuropathy. Any feedback on capsaicin gelling on the skin? Maybe I didn't get it correct, but it's capsaicin on the skin for relief in diabetic neuropathy.
And what they're referring to is a patch or a kind of like a topical agent called Qtenza. That's the company that does it with capsaicin cream, and they apply the capsaicin film/slash patch over the area where they're having pain, and that's left on for a few hours, and then they're able to then take it off and then go about their day. Now, when patients use that, like I mentioned with capsaicin, they have to be able to have tolerance to that initial burning that patients will feel, and that can be sustained for some time. And with each patient, they may not tolerate that level of burning, but if they can, it has been effective with treating pain. And so for those patients that can tolerate that burning sensation topically initially, they will, and most likely get relief from using Qtenza for, whatever their peripheral nerve pain needs could be, whether it's diabetic painful neuropathy or something different.
So Jasjit, will you do anything different now you've been in the business a while? You can tell that you love it. I can tell that you're very capable. Would you change your way of doing business?
I would not. I really enjoy working at Cooper and with Cooper Pain Management and Cooper Hospital Support. We have extremely, smart individuals there with leadership. We have extremely good resources and a good collaboration with different physicians, whether they be from cancer, endocrine, neurosurgery, orthopedics. And we work really well together to get down to the bottom of what is causing the patient pain and discomfort. And so, what I would say is no, I wouldn't. I really enjoy working at Cooper. They offer such a wide variety of services for patients, and I'm happy to be a part of the Cooper Pain Management team. I'm very proud to be a part of that team. And honestly, the only thing is I wish I had met you earlier, Dr. Fallon, because you've been a great mentor to me and helping with our efforts at Medical Society of New Jersey. You've worked with me pretty well with helping patients get the medical needs that they have, and then get their medical attention for their pathologies, because we've gone over some of the things that we've accomplished with prior authorizations and things like that. You can talk
That's
on it. That too on your talk show. Yep. Uh-huh. But yeah, I'm very happy to have been on the show, and thank you so much for listening.
All right. Your podcast will be up soon. Thank you very much, Jasjit. Excellent job. We'll be back next week. Inside Medicine signing out. Thank you much.